Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is a veterinarian, and he is the author of In Harriet's Shadow, Musings of a Country Veterinarian on Sunrises, Old Yellow Labs, and Well-Written Songs. Dr. Bill Stork is with us, and he has been writing a column for quite some time. He was writing so much and always wanted to write a book and had the idea for writing a book many years ago after he read James Harriet's All Creatures Great and Small. So he did the column, and there was more to say, and thus the book, which we're talking about this hour. We'll have a lot to talk about this hour. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. He graduated in May of 92, migrated across what he calls the Cheddar Curtain, and currently shares a 7-acre petting zoo with a displaced Wyoming cattle dog, an aging lab, 2 goats, a cat named Stinker, and 3 others, horses, and his partner Sheila. And we have a lot to discuss. The human-animal bond, never make a first impression and keep that first impression about somebody, because it certainly can change, and some of the extraordinary situations in which he has found himself. Dr. Bill Stork, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you for having me.
That's one of those things when I think about a life that would have been, although I never could have done it, to be a veterinarian. You know, I want to hear about when that thought was something that was in your mind. Were you a kid?
I was a kid, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 5th or 6th grade. I was always the kid on the block who watched everybody's dogs and cats when they went on vacations. Sometimes that worked out well, sometimes that worked out not so well, but as they say, no animals were harmed in the filming of this movie. But probably James Harriet and All Creatures Great and Small was responsible for flipping the switch. And I call that the book that cost my poor dad thousands of hours of overtime and $150,000 of tuition to veterinary school.
Yeah, it's a long haul, isn't it?
And I read that book in about 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And at no point did I remember how to fix a cow's foot or replace a displaced abomasum. But what I remember from All Creatures Great and Small is the feel, the relationship that Dr. Harriet had with his patients, with his clients, with his friends, with the community, how he represented himself, his family, the profession, and the human-animal bond. And I guess I made that decision in about 8th grade that that's what I would really like to have for myself someday.
Mm-hmm. And that human-animal bond, it's something that we are realizing more and more how strong it is. And you surely have instances of that bond in your book. People you think wouldn't do anything for their animals who wind up selling their Harleys to get an operation for a dog. It is so strong, isn't it? Tell me a couple of examples of what you've seen in terms of that bond and why it's so strong.
I think it's beyond a bond. I think it's more of an interdependence. And I think some of the beauty that I've seen in the process of human-animal bonds, and you touched on a man named Dan. And Dan, probably 10 or 15 years ago, taught me the lesson, or retaught me the lesson that my mom set forth around the dinner table when I was a kid. And that is that there is no way, it's human nature, that we're going to make first impressions based on the way somebody walks, talks, dresses, or acts. But we are obligated to give them a second chance to make a first impression. And Dan was no different than that. He approached our clinic an hour or so after we were supposed to close on a Friday evening. And it was fairly clear that ours was not his first stop after he got off from work, kind of based on how he meandered his way from his pickup truck to our back door and threw a cigarette on the front porch of our clinic. And believe me when I tell you, my first reaction was not that of benevolence, but I was pretty concerned, as my staff was, about the 3-legged lame dog that was dragging behind him. And over the course of the next 6 months, we learned that the guy would do anything for his dog, including sell his Harley-Davidson, which, by my way of thinking, was probably about all he had at that time, aside from his dog.
And sometime later, after you did the operation, the dog grew old, and you were there to see him die, right?
I got to be there when I saw him die, and at this point in time, if there's any other veterinarians around the state listening to me, they may be cringing because I'm about to out us. We hear very frequently, I heard it yesterday, this must be, meaning euthanasia, must be the absolute worst part of your job. And I will tell you that I have never woken up in the morning and thought to myself, well, I hope I can go euthanize some dogs. But what I will tell you is that we have seen amazing beauty, both in the animals that we are saying goodbye to and the people who care for them at that particular time, because people are most vulnerable. And you learn a lot about people, that a lot of people who you may not have given the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. I've been at that table before, and there is something remarkably peaceful about it, particularly if your animal is old and you know that there is a time to every purpose and you feel it, then it doesn't lessen the impact of losing a pet, certainly, but there is something about being there when that happens that it's a good place to be.
We like to say that we work hard to spare them their worst day.
Mm-hmm.
And for young people, and we're going to have to think of something to get a little bit lighter after we after we get off this particular topic. But often families will hesitate at the notion of including their kids, especially their young kids, at the moment of saying goodbye to their pets, and they'll even go so far as to protect them from that moment. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned, and if we are asked, if we're given the opportunity to input, I will suggest that at the time that we euthanize a pet, and oftentimes the pet was in the life before the kids were, they didn't know life without the dog. My dog named Cooter is a perfect example, because he was 5 years old when my daughter was born. It's an opportunity for kids to learn about the grieving process, to learn that it is okay to hurt. It's okay to cry until it hurts, and then it's okay to laugh again, and it's okay to cry all over again, because eventually there will be other family members that they'll lose as well.
Right. And they will be able, I really do believe that if you're a pet lover and you know how to take care of a pet and you enjoy the experience, you get another pet. There are a lot of dogs out there. There are a lot of cats out there, right?
There are, and there's a lot of them in shelters, and there's a lot of wonderful people doing work in rescues that are bringing together pets and families, and the relationships are amazing.
Yeah. So you were telling me before you went on the air that you were playing with Cooter, who's getting up there in years, as my dog is, before you came in. Cooter's really been of service, hasn't Cooter?
Well, Cooter has been a service. Cooter actually passed a number of years ago. My friend that I was playing fetch with in the yard before I came here is a girl named Remy. And, boy, we just keep being dark here, but that's okay, because Remy has taught me a lesson, has reminded me of a lesson that I've learned a number of times throughout 20 years in veterinary practice. And that is, as veterinarians, we get the idea that we know who is going to live, thrive, and survive, and who's not necessarily going to make it. And quite honestly, the week after Thanksgiving, I didn't think Remy was going to see Christmas. And nothing about her blood work, nothing about her diagnostics suggested that she should even make Christmas time. But I've also learned that there's a triangle. There is the pet, there's the patient, there's the veterinarian, and there's the owner. In this particular case, I'm the owner and the veterinarian, as well as Sheila. And what I've learned is that on any given day, if somebody is willing to try, and there's another dog named Ripped who is spoken about in the book, and on any given day, two out of the three may be ready to say goodbye. But if I, as a veterinarian, if the owner who cares about that dog, or if the dog lifts his head, comes for a meal, or does something beyond what it is that is expected, 90% of the time we know who's going to live, thrive, and survive. Mm-hmm. We work really hard for that 10% that surprises us beyond all capabilities. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the writing. You've been writing for a long time, and you write not only about dogs and cats and cows and your experiences as a vet, but you write about your mom and your dad and values and music and moving to Wisconsin. Have you kept a diary for a long time, or how did it come about?
You didn't actually read the book. did you, Kathleen? But yeah, that covers a whole lot about what it is that I've written about. Well, first of all, they call this genre, or I call this genre, creative nonfiction, and that comes in really convenient. And I'd really like to be clear about what that means to me. Mm-hmm. And throughout 23 years in veterinary practice and 50 years of life now, there are moments that make an impression on me. Maybe it was my barber when I was in college. Plenty of the impressions were made on me by my parents, by friends that I work with at a tackle store in Decatur, Illinois, and absolutely positively by the farmers and friends that I've had in the course of practice. An impression was made. And what it is that I remembered over these 50 years is the impression, and I like to build the stories from that. And I can say with 100% honesty that every one of these stories, however many there are in the book, the punchline is honest to goodness as it happened. Merry Christmas, Sally, all of these stories, the core is very, very true. The creative part comes in handy when either I don't remember the details, or in some cases, there are a few stories where the names and identities of the characters involved have been changed, the location has been moved, because the topics of the stories are intensely personal.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your growing up for a while, because it's an interesting story, and it, in some ways, it sort of reads like a Norman Rockwell upbringing, that you had snacks when you got home from school. Your mom was there to greet you. It sounded like a very warm and nurturing environment. Do you think that's the way to grow up? Do you think that we've had a hard time adjusting to a world that's quite different than that?
I think it's a way to grow up. And it's a good way to grow up, I would say. And in my particular case, there was some period of time where it was really popular to blame any of your shortcomings on your parents. I can't do that, because I was raised, as I say, by a get-her-done, Carhartt and calluses, square-shoulder kind of construction working dad who came home telling me that if you gave the boss man 8 hours work for 8 hours of pay, he'd keep you eating steak, or he'd keep you eating hamburger if you kept him eating steak. And we would sit down at the dinner table every night, mom, dad, and oftentimes a neighbor who needed help rebuilding the carburetor or putting an exhaust system on his car. And around the table we'd go sharing our days. And my mom was the kind of lady who would sit around and take it all in. She'd listen to what it is that we were saying. And I will tell you that construction working dads don't always come home and say, boy, that Red sure is one heck of a nice guy to work with. Just as I would come home from school and say things like, boy, Cindy Bowdery sure does have to make sure she's a part of every conversation and she has to one-up everybody. And my mom was the woman who would say, well, maybe at home, somebody's not necessarily paying attention to Cindy. Maybe her parents aren't home.
Aww.
Maybe she only has one parent.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say that if somebody were to walk up and spit on my mom's brand new pair of shoes, she'd give you a big hug, because surely you must be having a horrible day. And in some way, shape, or form, she must be able to help you.
Did she like animals?
She liked animals. She did. She didn't love animals. I'm not exactly sure where that came from, unless, as you asked that question, I took a step back, because my parents were the first off the farm. My uncles, my grandparents were all farms in central Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And you had some kind of job. I can't remember how old you were, but this must have sparked an interest, too, of cleaning out the cages or the sheds for a local veterinarian. You really did some unpleasant kind of work. I would think it was unpleasant. Maybe you liked it.
Well, maybe that job was meant to see if it could break my spirit, because old folks like to say I work for $2.50 an hour cleaning kennels and cleaning out box stalls and barns, and that is absolutely the case. And I worked for a veterinarian in central Illinois named Dr. Bill Van Alstyne at the Brush College Animal Hospital. And Bill Van Alstyne, once again, a little bit like Dr. Harriet in All Creatures Great and Small, I didn't watch him closely enough to figure out how to spay a dog. But what I did recognize is that he did a lot of house calls. He cried with his patients. He shook hands with everybody. He hugged his clients when he had to deliver a sobering prognosis or a diagnosis for them. And once again, he set the tone as to the beauty of the profession.
Mm-hmm. So that was a huge influence. It may be one of the reasons you went into it.
Absolutely.
How long do you have to study to become a veterinarian?
Well, veterinary school itself is a four-year program. It oftentimes at least takes a bachelor's degree to get into veterinary school. Mm-hmm. So round trip, it can be 8 years. And everybody comes at it from a different angle. I had classmates who graduated from veterinary school when they were in their 40s because they had a career first. Their spouses had a career first, and then they went back to school later. We had some 60-hour wonders who got into veterinary school after only 2 years of undergrad, but round numbers, 8 years.
Mm-hmm. And you decided to be a veterinarian in a kind of a country setting in the state of Wisconsin. I would imagine you can choose pretty much where you want to go. Was there a reason you wanted to find a place that was it similar to an area you grew up or not?
No, not at all. And I'm gonna own that moniker, small town veterinarian, as long as I can. For those in the audience who have been to Lake Mills, we have both a stoplight and a Walgreens now.
You do.
So it's slipping away from us at a breakneck rate of speed. But what brought me to South Central Wisconsin is one, the hills and the lakes and the beauty of it all, the dairy cattle, because I very much enjoy working for dairy farms on cattle, dogs and cats, with a smattering of horses and sheep and backyard hobby farms as well.
Mm-hmm. Why do you enjoy working on dairy farms with cows?
I enjoy working on dairy farms. I think it's an extension of growing up with construction workers, because I find farmers among the noblest, most productive people that I've ever met.
They work very, very hard, don't they?
Yes, they do.
You've been called in the middle of the night, I would imagine, on more than one occasion to do an operation for an animal in trouble.
I have, and I won't always tell you that my initial response is elegant. Very seldom when that phone rings do I take a look at that caller ID or retrieve that message and say, boy, I was just hoping I'd get to launch out in the middle of January and pull a calf. As a matter of fact, there's times when projectiles will fly. But by the time thankfully we don't just take off in our underwear, by the time I get the coveralls on and the truck warmed up, and certainly by the time you arrive at the farm, our clients are solid gold, and the enormous majority of them, they feel as badly about having to call you as you do about being called. And by the time they've called you, they need you. And some of the most meaningful experiences that I've had have not necessarily taken place between 8 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the evening. These relationships that we talk about throughout that book, there's one in particular with a man named Brian Zobel. And Brian was a herdsman on a farm on Highway 12 and 18 just east of Madison that I can honestly say that I got to work with the man. And we laid shoulder to shoulder behind cows, pulling calves, and it was, by the time you get back to the truck, it's very gratifying. And if things go well, obviously that's the ultimate payoff. Mm-hmm. And you work really hard to ensure that if they mm-hmm. don't turn out well, you did everything you possibly could to ensure that they did.
Is that the story where you had cheerleaders with you? It was a Badger game of some kind that was going on, or is that another delivery?
Well, that's another delivery, and part of the reason why Matt, who we were speaking about in that particular story, and that speaks to the beauty of what exists outside of the city limits of Milwaukee. Matt and his wife milked cows later on in the evening, and the reason why they milk cows later on in the evening is so that when their kids get off the school bus, they can greet their kids, they can all eat together, they can work on homework together, they can have family time together, and then they go to the barn and they milk cows. And that particular episode, I believe I titled that story, Give Me a C. It took place not in the middle of the night, but during Russell Wilson's epic march so that the University of Wisconsin won the Big Ten championship his senior year. And we were listening to that football game while we were in the process of correcting a uterine torsion. In some twist, no pun intended, of fate, it's not unusual for calves and the uterus that they're living in to get turned 180 to 360 degrees. And if all goes well, you can, in the ultimate arm wrestling match, you can rock them back and forth and correct it. And on this particular day, Matt and his wife and two of his kids were with me. And it, in every sense of the word, it's a one-person operation. There's only room for one person in that particular orientation. And Matt asked me, do you think a chair might help?
Oh.
And I looked at him as if, you know, Matt, that's exactly what they recommend in situations like this, and as if they had rehearsed it for days. He and his wife and his two kids launched into a cheer.
And it worked, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And so why is it not unusual to be in a situation like that? Is nature off course somehow?
I don't think so. I think if it were to happen in the wild, so to speak, regrettably, that calf would not be born.
Right.
And in production, one thing you have to keep in mind is, as veterinarians, we see a very skewed cross-section of births. The births that we see, the reason why we see them is because there's something unusual about that presentation. And there's tens of thousands of births out there that take place that we never see because it takes place as was intended.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls if people would like to join our conversation and share your stories about your animals or calling your veterinarian or the bond. I think one of the themes of the hour is the bond between human beings and their pets. Dr. Bill Stork is our guest, and his book is not only what he has encountered as a veterinarian, but his thoughts on life and music and family and his parents growing up and living in Lake Mills. The book is In Harriet's Shadow, Musings of a Country Veterinarian on Sunrises, Old Yellow Labs, and Well-Written Songs. He is at Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic and is a graduate of the University of Illinois. And so he's our guest this hour. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Dr. Bill Stork is our guest. He's a veterinarian and author of In Harriet's Shadow, Musings of a Country Veterinarian on Sunrises, Old Yellow Labs, and Well-Written Songs. And we go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, starting with Artis in Delafield. Hi, Artis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share in January, 2 weeks apart, we lost our 20-year-old female cat, passed away, and as well as our 14-year-old Rottweiler. And it's very difficult. We have, adopted another cat and another dog, obviously. But these are two just amazing animals. You know, it was very, very difficult. And, you know, I find myself just remembering things, and we're planting trees for each of them this spring. We also have a wonderful at-home vet. Her name is Dr. Dionne through Cherish Companions Mobile Veterinary Service, and she's been with us for over 10 years. And, you know, her response to these, coming right out, Molly passed away at home, the cat, and she was there within an hour. And with our Rottweiler, she had to be put down, but she had leukemia that progressed pretty quickly, And, you know, she was there when she's always been there when we needed her.
Yeah. And it's hard when you've had an animal. I'm glad you've replaced your animals. But when you've had an animal that long, that's you've just got all kinds of memories built up, too. So it's going to be a hard loss. Is the idea of mobile veterinarians something new or something that's been resurrected, Dr. Stork?
It's been taking place for a good long time. And it's certainly a different take on the profession. And you have to. You have to plan accordingly, and it's very difficult for a brick-and-mortar, so to speak, veterinarian to also do mobile work. It's something that you more have to commit to.
Mm-hmm. Did you train to be a big animal veterinarian? Are there specialties, or you just do both naturally?
At the time I was in veterinary school, I graduated in 1992. For the first 3 years of the program, you were in vet school, and in your senior year, your fourth year of veterinary school, you were required to take a certain number of rotations in every discipline, large animal, production animal medicine, equine, surgery, ophthalmology, and small animal, and so on. But you could emphasize your particular areas of interest so that you could become more qualified in those particular areas.
Do you have a preference? Do you prefer dogs and cats or cows?
I get asked that fairly frequently, and quite honestly, they're almost like two professions because it's very much a shift of paradigm. When I'm in the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, I'm in the companion and the pet paradigm. Mm-hmm. When I get in my truck and I go to the farm, we're in the production animal paradigm, but I have a soapbox that could take this show and several more beyond that just because farmers may have 1,000 cows, that's not to be mistaken for the fact that they take exquisite care of those cows and are extremely familiar with them and provide amazing feed environments for those animals.
Mm-hmm. A book reviewer on Amazon wrote, "I know Dr. Stork and his writing captures my interest in emotions. I'm reading his stories tonight as I'm watching my oldest cow to see that she has her calf without problems."
There we go back to that euthanasia thing again. That man's name is Glenn Rumler, and he is one of the reasons why I love to practice in the country and why I love to practice large animal medicine. There's a lot said about farming in the 80s, and Glenn was a victim of farming in the 80s and was forced to take a job in town. And Glenn couldn't stand the sight of an empty barn. And as a matter of fact, you can see the path in the yard during the years when he had no cows, when he would walk around the barn rather than look at it. And the cow that he was referring to is one of what we call the flower children, Iris and on down. And he bought a few calves and eventually grew them, bred them, and started to have a small beef herd of his own. And on Glenn's farm, he has approximately 18 or 20 beef cows, all of whom respond to their name, all of which come in the barn to be fed every day, and none will leave the barn until they've had their backs scratched.
Are cows smart?
I think they are. The cows definitely form associations, and they develop patterns.
Thanks for your call, artist. Let's go next to Angela in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Dr. Bill. This
Hello.
Is a voice from your past.
Oh my gosh, Angela Martin. How are you today?
I was a student, as a certain certified veterinary technician student, and as part of our rotations, when you get exposed to all different works of veterinary medicine, you have to go ride in a farm with a large animal truck, and I was a big city girl, and I know how a lot of farmers work their ways out there, and I really didn't want to be exposed to it at all. But I got to tell you, riding around the farm truck with Dr. Bill was one of the funnest times ever when I used to work in veterinary medicine. And we would show up to the farm, and the first person to meet us at the truck would be the dog.
Aww.
And Dr. Bill would very wisely say, "That's the true boss of the farm. If you're in good with that dog, you're in good." So I would always make over the dogs. And we showed up to one farm, and this very friendly dog came right up to the truck welcoming us up. And I went to get out of the truck to welcome the dog. And Dr. Bill leaves over and says, "Except that one. Don't touch that dog."
Huh.
Why wouldn't I touch the dog? It seems friendly. Does he bite? No, just don't touch that dog. we go to the barn and we're helping out a cow who didn't freshen when she delivered. Things didn't all pass out like they should have, and they were in there festering, and it could be rather foul. It's not a pretty place to be in a barn. And so we're working with this cow, and I tend to turn around, and here is this dog rolling in all of this foulness and lapping it up. So I learned to trust Dr. Bill that when he says, don't touch that dog, don't touch that dog.
Well, that's one of...
So I just wanted to say thank you for your stories of people that inspired you, because you are in turn inspiring lots of other people.
Well, thanks, but if you can't have fun with a classically trained Steve Earle fiddling maniac like you, I don't know if you can have fun.
Are you a vet now, Angela?
No, I am not. He was just kind of referring. I've gone full circle back to my original roots, which was as a musician.
I see.
So I'm now back to being music, and that was another great topic to talk to Dr. Bill about.
Very nice. Thank you, Angela, very much
Thank
for
you.
Your call.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye. Let's go to Lynn in La Crosse next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I'm wondering, I have two pet sheep, Annabelle and Isabel. And Isabel, and they're both 8 years old, Isabel has urine scald for the past 4 years, and I believe it's due to her constitution. I get out, I have them sheared yearly, but I get out and crutch, I think that's the word, crutch, her back end, and then I put some salve on it. I usually use a tea tree and a coconut oil. I have used Blue Coat, but I'm just curious what your recommendations might be. I don't want the bot flies to get to her, so I'm just curious about what you might say about how I can help her out.
Well, if I'm in La Crosse and I have two sheep that have urine scald, I think the best thing that you could do to them is point them uphill, in which case the urine would fall farther away from them and it would be much less of an issue, unless, of course, they insist on standing on the side of one of those hills that you have in La Crosse. Honestly, there's no magic for what it is that you're describing, and that's absolutely the case. There's no way to get them to project their urine farther from their body, and something that serves as a physical barrier is going to help you out the most. I would honestly recommend that you contact your local veterinarians in that area, and I know you have several excellent veterinarians in that area, because there very well may be things having to do with the body condition of those sheep or their environment that may be able to help you out in that department. But the short answer is a physical barrier that you have described, like Vaseline or bag balm and things like that.
Hmm. Do you have sheep?
I do not. I have two goats.
Hmm. Pet goats?
In a sense, they're pet goats, and they're also land clearing goats, because when you're 6 foot three and you like to walk through a rather wooded part of your property, it comes in really handy to have tall goats, because if you can contain them within a fence, they will eat everything from the ground up to about 6'4".
Huh, really? I guess they are serving a purpose. Are they fun to be around? I don't know too many goats.
They are comical.
They are.
Unless, of course, you're trying to keep them within a fence.
Right. Thanks very much, Lynn, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And let us go next to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Yes, I just called to simply say I regard veterinarians as sort of like priests, and I don't mean in any strict denominational sense. I mean that they are sort of guides along with our companion animals for some of the most meaningful and difficult parts of life. And I've had really good experience with veterinarians in terms of keeping me realistic. We're guiding an 11-year-old black lab, big old male black lab, through his last days.
Oh, I know that dog, Rich. Oh, your dog.
I'll leave it at that.
Rich, and I'll respond in a couple of different ways. One is I have to be really careful because under the review on Amazon that Kathleen did read, there was a less flattering review on Amazon, and in that less flattering review of our book, I was referred to as being a religious zealot or something to that effect, because in the book, In Harriet's Shadow, there are stories that speak to my faith. The thing about it is, I am a person of faith, but in no way, shape, or form do I require that. That's just simply how it is that I account for some of these stories. As for the positive experiences that you've had with your veterinarians in the Rhinelander area, first of all, thank you. You have no idea how much that means to us. I, too, have had excellent experiences with veterinarians, and I say that not necessarily tongue-in-cheek, because it's a pretty collegial group of people, and when I gather with other veterinarians, it's a group that I'm proud to be part of. And comments like yours, Rich, are amazingly motivational to us. And it keeps us between the lines, because there is such a thing as compassion fatigue. And after so many years of pounding it out, we can get tired. And the telephone calls like yours mean the world.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Rich is a good dog, Dad. I know that dog. Are there people still going into veterinary school?
There are people still going into veterinary school, and when people ask me, do you think I should go to vet school, my response is, if you're thinking about maybe going to veterinary school, it's no place for you. And the reason why I say that is because if anyone can be easily detoured from whatever it is that they're going to go into, whether it's auto mechanics or veterinary medicine, it's probably not a place for you. Not to mention the fact that right now, and there's a number of factors contributing to this, it's not a great value in education. In a couple of months, in about a month, there's going to be 80-some graduates from the University of Wisconsin College of Veterinary Medicine who are going to walk across the stage and get a diploma, and they're going to launch out into the world with an average of $175,000 to $200,000 worth of student loan debt, and their starting salaries are going to be in the vicinity of $50,000 to $60,000 if they can find jobs.
Really?
Indeed. And there are some other factors at work, and briefly, and this is in no way, shape, or form is this, oh, woe is me. This is just as it is. 08 through 12 served to suppress what would have been retirement for a whole lot of veterinarians. So there's a lot of veterinarians who would have loved to have retired and made room for the new graduates who have not been able to do that. In addition to the fact that a great way for colleges to cut budgets, or for universities to cut budgets, is to cut research dollars. In doing so, the only way for colleges to be able to cash flow is increase admissions. And a number of the veterinary schools around the country are actually increasing admissions. It's going to be a crowded profession in the near future. Hmm. It will all level out, and they'll find some place for us, but... That said, it's a beautiful and noble profession once you're there. And there are others. There are Tiffany Terinsky. Tiffany Terinsky came to our clinic as a job shadow, and she was going to be a veterinarian, period. You could not have stopped her from being a veterinarian in spite of the fact that she weighs about 105 pounds with a Mack truck. And sure enough, she starts at the University of Wisconsin next August.
In veterinary school.
You bet.
I love that description. It's a beautiful and noble profession. Isn't that nice to call? It's an honor to call yourself a member of that kind of profession.
It is, and I hope lots of people feel that way about their professions. My dad worked construction, and he felt very much that way. He was a union construction worker, and I know there's a lot of circles where that can be a bad word, but his take on being a union man was, if you're going to wear the union badge, if you're going to collect the union pay, you better wake up in the morning, show up a little bit earlier, a little bit more prepared, and produce more and produce better than the guy that isn't collecting the union wage and isn't wearing the union badge.
We go next to Amy in Janesville. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to thank Dr. Bill for speaking so eloquently about a profession that I love. I've been a primarily a dairy veterinarian for 26 years. And you have addressed very well the animal-human bond. But if you could, you touched on a little bit, if you could highlight the human-veterinarian bond, both in the companion and the large animal practices, I find that that is one of the most rewarding things that I have seen in my profession is the relationship I have with my clients. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Amy, you are absolutely correct. And as I said, that's one of the things that I took away from All Creatures Great and Small. And that's one of the things that I took away from my experience at the Brush College Animal Hospital with Dr. Van Alstyne. And partially, veterinary medicine, veterinarians may select for people who wake up in the morning, put their feet on the ground, and go out and look for the good in people. And especially as veterinarians, we get to deal with people, are privileged on a daily basis to deal with people who love their animals. And there's all kinds of quotes out there about people. You can get a true measure of a humanity when you watch how it is that they treat their animals. And some of these people and some of the stories in my book speak to stereotypes. I say that I really encourage people to push past stereotypes and preconceived notions based on how people may walk, dress, use the English language, and actively look for what it is that makes them, what makes them beautiful. And if you do that, it's stunning, the people that you will meet of every single walk and race. As an example, two of the favorite clients who've ever walked through the door of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, and I will use their real names, they are Dennis and Gloria Vergens. And Dennis mows grass and plows snow for a living, and Gloria cleans the bathroom at Walmart. And one, Gloria represents cleaning bathrooms at Walmart as if she came out and told me once upon a time, she said, Dr. Stork, if you go into the bathroom at the Walmart in Jefferson, Wisconsin, and the counters are clean and wiped up and the paper towels are stocked and it smells good, you're going to have a better experience at Walmart.
How true.
That which would require me to go in a Walmart. And if I were ever going to go in a Walmart, I would go in hers for that exact purpose. At the same time, if I were to tell Dennis and Gloria Vergens that in order to tell them if I could fix their cat, JD or Tigger, would require $1,000 and an MRI, they would go out and clean bathrooms and mow grass until they had $1,000 to do that MRI. And getting back to Rich, who called earlier, you guys trust us, and that means the world to us. And we will work as hard as we possibly can to continue to earn that trust.
We go to Jeanette in Illinois. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I identify with mentioning the wonderful experiences in barns. My mom and dad were married in 65, and we farmed in northeast Iowa at dairy farms. And mom described the ringing in the New Year's one year, I think before I was born, waiting for a calf to be born is one of the best times she'd spent with my dad, and just the wonder of the birth. But it was interesting that your program is today, because our rescue dog, Yellow Lab Tigger, is currently up at the UW in Madison undergoing surgery on her spine and for a growth that's pinching her spinal cord. And we don't know how it's going to come out. And I'd just like to say that all the vets I've known are really wonderful people, and I was really impressed with the staff up there. So no matter Tigger's outcome, I'm very grateful for their amount of caring for a really sweet dog.
Well, first of all, bless you for giving Tigger the opportunity. And it must be old dog day here, because Kathleen and I are staring across the table because we both have older aging dogs, mm-hmm. and we've heard from people around the state of Wisconsin and now down into Illinois. So what I can say is you've got the best on the job up there, and I can absolutely assure you that if the mask can be removed, they will.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking this hour of the program with Dr. Bill Stork, and he is the author of In Harriet's Shadow, Musings of a Country Veterinarian on Sunrises, Old Yellow Labs, and Well-Written Songs. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, and let's go to David in Omro. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Yes, David. Hi.
Hello. I can barely hear you, but...
We hear you, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I wanted to say to Bill that I appreciate veterinarians. excuse me. I'm an old farmer now, but when I took over from my dad, I was 37 years old.
Hmm.
And my local veterinarian came out, and I said to him, I didn't know that much when I was a kid, and I've been away from it, so I expect you to teach me. And the man did. He's long since passed, but one of the things I remember is we had a cow that I took over with my dad, and she must have been 10 years old, and every time the veterinarian walked in the barn, she just thrashed around and would just hated him until she came down with milk fever. In the middle of a blizzard, a bad one. Anyway, she came out, cured her, and the next 3 years of her life, she always was gentle when he walked in the barn.
Hmm.
Boy, I wish I could sit... I could say the same about a cow that I called number two on the left, because not only did she thrash around when I walked in the barn, but if I walked the width of 1 foot on her side of the barn, she would unceremoniously escort me to the barn floor. And no matter what it is that I did for that cow, and I fixed her feet, I treated her for milk fever, I even did a DA surgery on her. She in no way, shape, or form did she develop any kind of love for me.
Well, some of us just aren't grateful enough, huh?
I guess not, but I am grateful for that telephone call, and I
yes.
thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for the call. Very emotional. Thanks, David, for your call. Do you run into that a lot, and what do you do about, you know, dogs or animals? There are a few, there aren't many, but who may not like you very much.
There are a few. Well, speaking to the dogs and the cats at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, we have a distinct advantage, and it's to some extent the way we've chosen to brand ourselves, and that is in the form of a staff behaviorist. And we work really hard with anxious dogs, because very seldom are they're mean dogs. More likely they're anxious dogs, they're scared dogs. And Mitzi, our behaviorist, one, edited this book that's in front of us today, and without her, it absolutely positively would not exist. But two, we've had dogs that have come to our clinic for 2.5 to 3 months before we ever set hands on them. They would come to the clinic, make it as far as the parking lot. Somebody from the staff would walk out, hand them treats. They would walk around the building, play Frisbee, and they'd go home.
Huh.
And they would do this daily, until they would get to the point where we could actually lay our hands on them, and we could actually examine them, and we could actually do what it is that we needed to do to them. It's very gratifying, because there's a few of those dogs now. The owners, if they plan not to stop at the clinic, they have to detour, because the dog will bark out the window and howl so that they can come in and get some treats from us.
Oh, that's great. We have time for maybe one more phone call. The hour is flying by. Is it Dagmar in Madison?
Dagmar, yes.
Hi, Dagmar.
Yeah, thank you for this great program. You know, we went through tragedies, and to help animals was so healing. They never disappoint you. And I collected some of these great stories. There was a little blind little poodle they found in a snowstorm, and it was so loving. It helped many people. And one was a boy in a reformatory school who seemed hopeless. But when he met the poodle and heard his stories, it turned his life around, and he recovered. And the other one was about a kitty cat that was given to a neighbor by someone who couldn't deal with it. The kitty's hind legs didn't work, so she went to the vet, and the vet thought they should put it to sleep. And while they talked, the kitty fell off the table and pulled itself across the floor on its front legs. And she took the kitty home, massaged the legs. They partially worked again, and that kitty lived 20 years.
Oh, Goodness. You must have all kinds of stories like that in your mind.
Well, those stories are beautiful. And every time out, I hear other stories. I could write a book about writing a book and the people that I have met along the way.
Well, maybe that's book number two.
It's in the process.
Is it?
Oh, you bet.
All right. Good for you. Thank you so much for being with us. All the best to your noble profession.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
Our guest, Dr. Bill Storck, the book is In Harriet's Shadow, Musings of a Country Veterinarian on Sunrises, Old Yellow Labs, and Well-Written Songs. Great title for the book as well. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. I'll be with you again on Monday, next Monday at 1 o'clock. In case you don't know, we do an All Things Political program on Monday, and we'll be talking about a number of issues. The Senate today approved the nomination of Loretta Lynch for U.S. Attorney General. I'm sure that will be front and center of the things that we will discuss next Monday on All Things Political. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network.